Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, new developments in the Laquan McDonald case. Find out why more Chicago cops could be facing criminal charges. Donald Trump accuses Hillary Clinton of having contempt for American voters with her basket of deplorables comment. Well, wait till we break down the facts about those deplorables. Countdown to history, the Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture, grand opening over a week away, and it needs your help when it comes to your pocketbook. Plus, part two of my exclusive interview, living legend Harry Belafonte and criminal justice advocate Carmen Perez. We talk Black Lives Matter movement and how leadership is lagging at the grassroots level in the fight for justice and racial equality. We're trying to bring the funk on News One Now, right now. Clergy from all denominations across the nation are calling on leaders and political candidates to focus on what they say are the real moral issues facing the nation instead of extremist politics. Yesterday, Reverend Dr. William Barber II led what's known as the Moral Monday movement. Hundreds of folks representing educators, civil rights and voting rights groups, labor, environmental activists gather at 30 state capitals across the country demanding change. Took place in Raleigh, North Carolina, Tallahassee, Florida, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Indianapolis, Indiana, Boston, Atlanta, and many others. This, of course, has been a major initiative of Reverend Barber. Of course, he is the head of the NAACP conference in North Carolina. They have been on the front lines for the last 3 years, pushing and prodding people to get involved. He joins us right now via phone. He also is president of the Repairs of the Breach. Reverend Barber, glad to have you here on the show.
Hey, Brother Martin, how are you this morning?
First and foremost, when you talk about extending Moral Mondays beyond North Carolina, this is not a black movement. You all of a sudden, you have whites, even conservative whites, Hispanics and others who realize that the issues that African Americans have been championing also affects them.
Exactly. In fact, our entire movement is intergenerational, intersectional. It is diverse. It is a moral call, Martin. And what you saw yesterday, 30 state capitals, the District of Columbia, simultaneously, all at the same time, number one, challenging the limited moral construct of the so-called religious right. We're no longer going to allow them to continue to say that the only moral issues are prayer in the school, where you stand on abortion and homosexuality. We're going to force a conversation about poverty, health care, criminal justice reform, equal protection under the law, labor rights, immigrant rights, all which have deep resonance in our deepest religious and constitutional values. Secondly, we call for a moral vote. This time for people of conscience to come out of the sanctuary into the public square and into the ballot box, November and beyond, and to begin to promote and teach the values of justice. And this is not new, Mark. You know that we wouldn't have had a Reconstruction movement in America without the moral votes. We wouldn't have had the social gospel movement. We wouldn't have had the civil rights movement. And so yesterday was called the Higher Ground Moral Declaration. We made a declaration of where we're going forward.
And exactly what is that declaration?
If you go to www.moralrevival.org, we actually put together a policy document with some of the best theologians, historians, and policy workers. It is called a Higher Ground Moral Declaration. It's 9 areas, starting with democracy and voting, ending with addressing warmongering and issues of peace. And in between, we deal with health care, living wages, criminal justice reform, xenophobia, immigrant rights. And in that, we lay out from our religious tradition the texts that speak to those issues, then from the Constitution, the texts that speak to those issues, and then policy analysis. And we're asking from the president, governors, all the way down, is health care, for instance, a moral issue? If it is, then why are you fighting it? If it's not, then tell us why you believe that making sure, for instance, people have health care is the wrong thing to do. voting rights are all issues. It's criminal justice and dealing with police brutality and moral issues. We have to change this limited framework. Some things are not just about left and right. It's about what's right and what's wrong. It's a policy document. And but the last thing I'd say to you on that issue is that people often ask me, is someone a racist in their heart, or are they engaged in classism in their heart? That's not how you determine racism and classism. You have to look at the heart of policy. Where do they stand on policy, and how does it impact? You find out what they treasure in policy, you'll know where their heart is.
Obviously, you're there in North Carolina. There has been a significant effort by Republicans there to suppress the vote. They have, in the local board of elections, they have slashed almost by half early voting on Sunday. They've slashed early voting hours as well. They wanted to do away with Sunday voting across the board. How do you believe these efforts are going to impact early voting, which starts in North Carolina in a few weeks?
Well, actually, and that's another reason why our moral declaration has to be about the vote. You know, this past Thursday, we were able to win back a number of things through the Board of Election. Our lawyers are giving me a review today because we may be back in court, Roland. The reality is that the Republican leadership in our state, after we won our case all the way to the Supreme Court, sent out a memo and instructed their members of board election to pass Republican values and not constitutional values. We believe this is an attempt to undermine our victory in the courts. So we are now, we're organizing 1,300 congregations, thousands of people to be engaged. We may end up back in court, but they are trying to suppress the vote because they know that a fully engaged electorate, if African Americans vote at 70% like it did 208, 212, Then they cannot survive that if we hook up with Latinos and progressive whites. So we're making an all-out effort in the court and all-out effort in training. I'm doing 16 stops across this state over the next month to, in fact, get our people out to the polls in a massive way.
All right. Reverend Dr. William Barber, we appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, my friend. Take care.
Thank you, sir. Let's go to our panel. Dr. Christopher Metzler, political scientist and president, CEO of FHW Fit. Lauren Victoria Burke, political analyst, writer for NBC Black. Dr. Cleo Monago, behavioral health expert and CEO of Black Men's Exchange. What I find to be interesting about the Moral Monday movement is that when it started, it largely was African Americans. And then all of a sudden, as they went around North Carolina, as I always say, broke white folks begin to realize that they were in the same boat as a whole bunch of black folks and Latinos. And so when they begin to assess the cuts to police and fire and teachers, the refusal to accept Medicaid expansion, and all of a sudden rural hospitals begin to shut down, all of a sudden white folks in North Carolina begin to say, whoa, we might want to pay attention. This hurting us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a great movement in terms of diversity. There's no question about that. I just wonder, with some of these movements, particularly when it's sort of based on marching, what the quantifiable results are. Certainly with Black Lives Matter, they get criticized all the time for, oh, you're just marching and you're not really doing anything. So I wonder with Moral Mondays why it's seen differently when they do it. I think it's because it's an older group of marchers, but certainly, you know, focusing on voting rights in North Carolina is the right thing. I just wonder what their quantifiable results are.
Well, first of all, one of the things that they've done is that, in talking to Reverend Barber, one of the things that they've done is you had a very popular governor who they brought his approval numbers down the high 20s a little more than a year ago. Now, all of a sudden, you look at the numbers in North Carolina, he is now down 7 points, according to the polls, when it comes to reelection in that particular state. And what they also have been doing is getting other folks. I think enlightenment is also part of this. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. I look at Colin Kaepernick and people complaining, but what are you going to do now? There are a lot of folks who they're trying, who enlightening first say, look, You got to understand what the issues are, and then all of a sudden say, now how do you impact that? When it comes to public policy, building that is important because you just can't go from just marching to all of a sudden you got a plan in a matter of a couple of days.
Well, I think in the case of North Carolina, it's really about throwing people out of office. It's about throwing the governor out of office.
But first you gotta enlighten folks. Mm-hmm. Then you gotta mobilize them. Then you gotta organize them. Then you gotta get them registered, and then you gotta get them to vote. I mean, so it's several things you got to do.
Yeah, I mean, I do understand the whole need for the quantifiable results, but as Roland said, this has to be done in a strategic, and it also has to be done in a very, in small steps of small increments. You can't just go from marching to all of a sudden, here's what we're going to do, and here are going to be the outcomes.
Justify, or I should contextualize, the importance of marching?
No. What I'm trying to say is that when we talk about this particular movement, what often happens is folks want to go from raising an issue to, okay, what's your plan, without realizing that if the long-term plan is actually to throw people off, you literally have to get people to understand what the issues are, build it up, organize and mobilize them, and so you lead up to this presidential election, gubernatorial election. And so the plan, what they've been doing for the last 3 years, has always been about getting McCrory out of office. Mm-hmm. But you gotta build the people up to get them there, because you need hundreds of thousands of votes to make it happen.
Well, they're building it across the country, which is interesting. You know, I mean, I just think that...
They're taking the North Carolina model
right. And
saying, okay, this is how we organized and mobilized and were able to bring folks together to do this. This is how you could also do it other places as well.
Right.
Because what's the one thing we always hear? We want to do something, but we don't know what we want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's interesting that when we talk about Black Lives Matter sometimes, I mean, even the president criticized them on, you can't just march, or you can't just do this. When an older group of marches
I don't know who but I know I'll give Black Lives Matter credit, because it's the exact same thing.
Well, we is a lot of people. I mean, the president of the United States came out and criticized what was that?
But that's him.
He would never do that with obviously Reverend Barber.
But that's him. I'm not going to do it, because my deal is you have to organize and mobilize people in a certain way because you need numbers.
Yeah.
You need numbers.
Well, African Americans have been really good at doing that over history. We've been really good at mobilizing and organizing. I mean, to me, it's like, what point do you get to the point where you strike and where you get the result? That's what I think.
Well, because what happens is we've organized and mobilized prior to the election, but when the election was over, then did not sustain that mobilization then say, nah, I need y'all to do
because
what we voted for.
It's often based on emotions.
Yeah.
And it's often based on watching what people have done previously in history with all these newsreels of people marching and think this is what we do.
Right. Oh,
and so let's do it because it's going to result in something. But people don't have a clear, concise cause and effect plan that's going to lead to social change.
Well, because what happens is you don't have newsreels of people doing the actual work in meetings after the election. Yeah. And that's part of the deal. Yeah. Yeah. It's like I always say, nobody wants to talk about how strategic MLK and others were. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We won't talk about the speech.
Well,
speaking of speeches,
Marcus could complain about that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, speaking of speech,
they kind of say, "Look, don't do that this time."
Well, but the reality is, you got to mobilize folks somehow, some way. Speaking of speeches, yesterday Donald Trump was speaking in Baltimore. He ain't gonna see black people. He was talking to the National Guard, and he had some tough things to say about Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables comment. Okay, here's what Hillary said. I'm gonna tell y'all what Donald Trump said.
You could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
All right. Here's Donald Trump yesterday blasting Clinton.
I was thus deeply shocked and alarmed this Friday to hear my opponent attack, slander, smear, demean these wonderful, amazing people who are supporting our campaign by the millions. Our support comes from every part of America and every walk of life. Hillary Clinton spoke with hatred and derision for the people who make this country run. She spoke with contempt for the people who thanklessly follow the rules, pay their taxes, and scratch out a living for their family, a hard-earned living, too. The disdain that Hillary Clinton expressed toward millions of decent Americans disqualifies her from public service. You cannot run for president if you have such contempt in your heart for the American voter, and she does.
Well, clearly, the Trump campaign plans to use this as a major attack against Hillary Clinton. She later apologized for that comment. She said, of course, that she only regretted making, quote, a grossly generalistic statement and using the word deplorables. Well, okay, gotcha. All right. Sorry, using the word half. Okay, let me break this down to our panel. Chris, I want to start with you. NBC News Survey Monkey poll from February. Two-thirds of Trump supporters an unfavorable view of American Muslims. It's a fact. 87% wanted to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. Reuters Ipsos poll from June. 58% of Trump supporters had an unfavorable view of Muslims. 52% opposed rights for LGBT Americans. 50% of Trump backers saw blacks as violent and criminals. 40% said blacks were lazy and rude. Public policy poll in May. 65% of Trump supporters say President Obama is a secret Muslim. 59% say Obama was not born in the U.S. Pew Research Center poll this year. 69% of Trump supporters say immigrants are a burden to America. 50% say immigrants will commit serious crimes. Sound pretty damn deplorable to me.
Well, it's for me, it's a bad time to be a Republican. you know, because, look, first of all, for him to come out and to say that she's running a hate field campaign. It goes back to this whole notion of pot meat kettle. Because he, from the very beginning, started this whole kind of hate campaign. And so for him to say, and she's therefore disqualified from running from, come on, man, you know, move away from that.
Cleo?
Can I shake my just shake my head? Is that enough of a commentary?
Okay. All right, Lauren.
The whole thing is ridiculous. Obviously, I mean, we watched at Trump rallies, black people get pushed out of the rally by white supremacists.
Push, hit,
People get punched in the face in North Carolina. We have a candidate that didn't want to acknowledge who David Duke was, and then we found a reel of him talking about David Duke.
So Donald Trump, even yesterday,
Donald Trump wants to play this game of acting like his, and then he hires Steve Bannon. You know, I mean, this idea that somehow it's irrelevant, all of these things, and that they don't mean anything.
But even yesterday, his VP candidate, Governor Mike Pence of Indiana, would not even call David Duke deplorable.
I can remember the first real stop that Trump made was in Alabama. And I remember the reporters at the Post trying to sort of leave out of the story the fact that they'd heard the N-word and some of the racism at that rally. And that was, you know, that was almost a year ago. And it's sort of like, this is what this campaign has been. And that's what his supporters have been from the very beginning. Now, whether or not Hillary Clinton should have articulated that is another story, because I think a surrogate would have been better off saying that.
But Cleo, here's the problem. All these media pundits out here, oh my goodness, Hillary Clinton should apologize. No! Call it like it is. And it's like, and they are unwilling to say bigots.
Racism.
Very few of them look like us. But the reality is, I mean, I remember to your point about the rallies, they even would cloak it in terms of, well, they're unsettled about their changing racial dynamics of America.
Right.
And this is on NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN.
White reporters have always had a problem in our history with really calling out racism. It's very touchy.
They're unsettled by the racial change.
It's difficult to call a kettle white.
I think it's
calling the kettle white.
We saw during the Civil Rights Movement the same type of reporting.
Chris,
Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, when we talk about Trump, there are a number of things relative to this, the deplorables. First of all, his behavior throughout this entire election has been deplorable. So that's number one. Number two.
So he's deplorable in chief.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. Number two, I think she's right when she says, I was wrong for saying half, because I think it's probably more than half.
Right. She's factually correct. Right. Is it by 65%?
I think you have...
Including the press, who don't, like you said, who won't address issues, who won't unpack these issues, who won't call a man a bigot, who won't call him a racist, who won't call him a militant, white militant.
The press,
First of all, the press has created alt-right.
Right.
No,
that's right.
It's white supremacists.
Yeah.
It's white nationalists. Call it what it is. Stop coming up with a new name. Oh, it's the alt-right.
Yeah.
No, it's white supremacists. They can't wait for him to win.
Yeah.
I mean, they are, and your point, Steve Bannon, Rand Breitbart, Staffers said that man ran meetings like a white supremacist. Yo, that's what you got here.
David, how long have I been saying that similar sentiment on this show?
The David
Duke
thing.
Well, that's why we call you super black.
Alone. The fact that he won't even come out and denounce David Duke is huge.
Precisely. So, all right. Well, bottom line is, y'all, deplorables are running for president. Accept that as a reality. All right.
Deplorables are in the media running the media and not being real about racism in the world.
Well, that's true. But we real. When we come back, we'll tell you about the latest in the Laquan McDonald case out of Chicago. Could the cops face criminal charges? Also, countdown to the opening of the Museum of African American History and Culture. We'll have a preview. Plus, my interview with Harry Belafonte. All of that, News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
All right, folks, Laquan McDonald case out of Chicago. A grand jury will decide whether or not to charge more Chicago cops connected to the case. Yesterday, a judge signed off on a request by special prosecutor Patricia Brown Holmes to summon a grand jury to hear evidence. Although Holmes has not said how many officers are under investigation, last month, Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson moved to fire 7 cops involved in the case. Their versions of what happened during the 2014 shooting conflicted with a dash cam video that was released more than a year later. So far, Jason Van Dyke is the only officer charged in the case. He's facing murder charges for shooting McDonald 16 times as he walked away from him, even though he lied and said that McDonald was charging towards him in his police report. Prosecutor Holmes was appointed to the case last month and promised to get to the bottom of this case.
This is something that I think is very important to the public, that they get it, that we get it right, and that they have confidence in whatever the results might be.
Holmes says the grand jury will be formed by September 26th. There's no deadline for the grand jury to reach a decision. While leaving court, Holmes told reporters the grand jury process is viewed as the constitutional way to do it. It's more fair. You have 16 members of the grand jury as opposed to one individual making a decision. And any decision that's this weighty and important, I think the public would want to have, you know, some oversight. By having a grand jury, there's more than just me making a decision. So I'm not coming out and saying yay or nay. And people are like, whoa, wait a minute, what you do? And when asked if the McDonald case was one of the hardest cases she's ever worked, she said, quote, it's still early for me to say it's one of the hardest cases. It's a tough case. I have friends who are police officers, and I understand the family in this case. It's a case that tugs at you from both sides. All right, folks, let's go to a panel on this. Here's what's interesting. First and foremost, they're pursuing, first of all, these cops lied.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And typically, when police officers get busted for lying on police reports, nothing ever happens. But if either one of us filed a false police report, we could get prosecuted.
Yeah.
And so to me, this is what has to happen. I've always said, if a cop lies on a police report, it should be automatic firing.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, obviously, this is a case, a really good example of how there's a complete lack of accountability when we talk about police officers. And not only if one of us did that, but anybody in our military, anybody at any other job doing this and lying would be in trouble. I mean, we don't even have the standards for cops that we have for our military. There's no accountability for this profession, none. It's basically assumed that if you're a cop, it's a difficult job. And so if you do something wrong, you got it so hard.
All right. So y'all went to a Burger King and y'all erased the video.
Right.
And you lie on a report. You said he was charging you and he was running away. It's good.
This is active obstruction.
We'll let y'all off.
Text all of this, and this is redundant because we've talked about this a million times because unfortunately there keep being incidents to talk about. Mm-hmm. But the subtext of all of this is the dismissal of black life. And the dismissal of human beings, whether their lives have any value or not. And the other issue that I think we need to keep at the top of this is Emanuel. Is that his name?
Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago.
He was part of this cover-up as well. And he's still there. And people in the local community have been complaining about getting rid of him. He's cried and all kinds of stuff. And he's still in place. So I think it's important for us to look at the systemic level of this deceit.
Chris, bottom line is, when you don't hold officers accountable when they clearly lie. Mm. Because here's the piece. The superintendent is trying to fire 4 or 5 of these guys. Mm-hmm. But 3 of them quickly retire.
Of course.
And that's the other thing. Cops will quickly retire, so there's no penalty touching their pension. If you want to change the behavior of cops, if you want to change this culture, you must go after their pensions. And you must have a situation where you are criminally charging them for lying.
Yeah, I think it's the cops. I also think it's the prosecutors as well. Because in a lot of these cases, what happens is the prosecutors know that they can actually charge them and they refuse to do so. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the accountability has to go both for the cops and both for the prosecutors. That's the only way to do it.
Woman, I forgot her name, is allowing a grand jury to do this.
Right.
Because she doesn't want to be on the wrong side of the
law. There's a simpatico between, of course, the mayor, getting back to Rahm Emanuel for a second. In these cities, the mayor is the one that sort of lets the police do whatever the heck they want, that's and true. The police union, and this is how we find that's ourselves true. At this place. And that's a very consistent meme that you find through all these cases where these cops are not prosecuted. So without the accountability, without the ability of that public servant who's been elected to office standing up to the police, you get the same thing again.
Well, the other thing is this here. How the prosecutor prosecutes this before the grand jury matters.
Yeah.
In the case of Tim McGinty, Cuyahoga County in Cleveland with Tamir Rice, they basically operated as the defense attorneys for the cops. Right. And so that's the key as well.
That's what I'm saying.
Folks, got to go to a break. When we come back, the Museum of African American History and Culture needs you. We'll talk about a major fundraising campaign in advance of the museum's grand opening in a week. Also, civil rights icon Harry Belafonte says the black church must step up and step in the ring to fight for justice and equality in America. The second part, my exclusive interview with him and criminal justice activist Carmen Perez. Plus, box office numbers and Colin Kaepernick still protesting. Then wait till I tell you what a baseball player said about why there's no protest in baseball. He said, it's a white man's sport. 27 after the hour, News 1 Now, TV 1.
My name is Karen Bass. I'm a member of Congress from Los Angeles, California, and you only have one vote. Use it.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
September 24th, folks, will be a history-making day, and that is when the Museum of African American History and Culture will open in Washington, D.C. President Barack Obama, Michelle Obama will be on hand for the dedication ceremony. It will take place at 10 a.m. on that day in preparation for the grand opening and beyond. The museum is designating today, September 13th, as Giving Day. That means y'all got to give some money. That means throughout the day, you can go online and make a donation to the museum. Of course, think of it as your gift to African-American history. And look, I'm a charter member giver, so I gave the first year. All right, so it's time for folks to step up for a preview of the museum's grand opening. Let's chat with Beverly Morgan Welch, the Associate Director of External Affairs for the Smithsonian Museum of African-American History and Culture. Glad to have you here. First off, how much does this whole thing cost?
Overall, the capital costs for the museum are a good $550 million.
And you've had to raise how much of that?
Half of that.
And where are we to this point?
At this point, we are almost there for the capital costs. We've raised a lot more money, both some of that is endowment and programming funds, but we're almost there. That's why we're doing Giving Day.
Now, when we started this, President Obama said that he wanted all the money raised before the museum opened.
Yes, we've raised about $325 million.
And again, you've had folks who've been giving, who've been charter members, who've given small amounts, large amounts. Y'all had a big fundraiser, Denzel Washington, him and his wife, Paulette. How much did y'all raise there? Something like $12 million, $17 million, something like that?
At least over $10 million, yes.
Gotcha.
Yes, and we've got 118,000 charter members cumulatively. So that's a lot of people who've been giving to us, but there's still more out there. And already, we started at midnight, and there are a good 500 people who gave through the night, and we're almost at $100,000. So we're hoping to do much more.
Now, what's your goal for today?
Well, we haven't a pronounced goal, but Hyundai has given us a $500,000 matching
grant. So what you want to do is you want to raise at least $500,000 for Hyundai, for them to kick in the other $500,000.
Yes, absolutely.
Everybody here gave? Let me check.
Not yet.
Pull your phones out. Pull your phones out. What's the website?
www.give.
Leo, pull your phone out.
AAHC.org.
Pull your phone out. That's right. Y'all can give right now.
Yep.
That's right. Since y'all over there on the phone, get on Twitter and Facebook.
give NMAAHC. Okay.
So first and foremost, obviously, it's a huge focus. Give us a sense of what the opening day is going to be like.
It's going to be amazing. There's a festival.
Don't be cheap.
That's
go ahead, I'm sorry.
Going on. Our largest gift so far is $2,500. So $10 to $2,500.
Same thing for the crew. Y'all pull your phones out and give too. Go ahead.
Thank you. We are having a festival on the Washington Monument grounds to really bring the museum outside. And the dedication is going to be outside to allow as many people as possible to see and participate. Of course, President Obama will be there and his family, as well as President Bush and Laura Bush, since he signed the legislation. Mm-hmm. There will be a number of dignitaries, Supreme Court justices, congresspersons, international visitors, and a number of donors to the museum, from the smallest donors to the largest, as well as donors to our collections, civil rights icons. And this will be a magical moment of some speeches, but some wonderful music and performance that will really mark the day.
How many artifacts have been given?
37,000 at this point have been donated to the museum, and that was really the most difficult challenge, the idea of, do these artifacts exist? Where do they exist?
And then authenticating.
Yes, and of course, and then how do you preserve them? I mean, the preservation process and the cost of that is absolutely astronomical, but it is overwhelming as well to go into people's homes and have them give you items that they've been holding for very long and aren't sure always that they're authentic, but often are far more wonderful than anyone could possibly imagine.
How much Nat Turner stuff do you have?
How much?
Yeah, I know you have, like, I heard a story at one of the previews that there was the sword or his Bible was found, and it's in the museum.
The Bible.
Yeah.
We have his Bible in the museum.
It's amazing.
Absolutely.
Is the goal of the museum to also resist what we have been facing as a people? And I know there's a museum and there's going to be a display of relics and things that are connected to our past. Mm-hmm. But for example, the Jewish Museum is also a protest against further racism and anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. It's a resistance to it. That's the whole point of the Jewish memorial there. Is the black one have the same flavor, or is it mostly a museum and kind of like a relic celebration?
No, it's alive. Part of this is, of course, to tell people the history, because it's largely unknown.
Right.
By having, you know, an object that you can see that Harriet Tubman wore, that where Nat Turner prayed, causes you to have and make your own experience. And the history itself is one of resistance. So it is an active history, and it covers the movement to today. It doesn't end in some sort of a historical period of the 1800s, but continues.
Folks, you can give today. Give, GIVENMAAHC. Again, Hyundai has a matching grant of $500,000. So we raised $500,000 today. They'll kick in another $500,000. So we want you to do that. Of course, we're going to have coverage leading up to and on that day as well. And so on September 26th, our show on that day will actually be all of our coverage from the memorial, from the museum opening on that Saturday. We appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
All right, folks, when we come back, we'll hear from a living legend, Harry Belafonte, right here, News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Harry Belafonte is one of our greatest activists and artists. Well, we recently had a conversation with him, an exclusive with Harry Belafonte, criminal justice activist Carmen Perez. In this portion of our second interview, we chatted about Black Lives Matter movement, the role of the black church, and the fight for racial equality and freedom, plus the lack of leadership in grassroots organizations in America.
Most of my life, I have always prided myself in having a great sense of where we're going and the obstacles we're going to face, and that there are a lot of people I can make alliances with that will make a difference. And here I am now at this time in my life, well into my life, where I have come daily to understand that I don't really know what it's all about. When I look at Dr. King, when I look at Nelson Mandela, when I look at Eleanor Roosevelt, the first person who led me into a deeper understanding of the universal political world, she introduced me to a lot of Africans I would never have met, young men and women who were in rebellious mood, who were challenging the colonial system. They came to the United Nations as observers. She had a wonderful relationship with them, talking about the future. And that insight led me into a world of activism. And here I now sit at the gate of my 90th year in life, looking at the map, looking at the journey. And first of all, I can't believe that 90 years has come and gone. It's a blink. But more importantly, when I was 35 and when I was 30, or even when I was 28, when I first met Dr. King, he was 26. We were both quite young, and he had taken on the responsibility of that, of this struggle. Everything seemed fairly doable. Now, when we are in the kind of chaos we're in, universal chaos, and what's what we contribute on the domestic scene as well, the absence of a voices of authority, voices of creativity. We're the leaders, we're the writers, we're the spokespeople, we're the commentators that the political commentators that make a difference. Who are the writers? Who's commenting on the loss of our moral compass? Who speaks to that? And when I look around, I find that it's a fairly barren field.
Do you believe that's the case because the targets are so varied, as opposed to a more simple approach, that there are, so let's say, Carmen and I have discussed this, you talk about this effort with Black Lives Matter movement, that it's really not a federal fight. It's really state by state, mm-hmm. city by city. And that's a different type of battle than sort of having one force to sort of go after.
Well, when you make the distinction between what you call a federal fight and what the opposition would refer to as an act of state rights, then I think we have a debate. Because I think most of it's a federal problem. When you start tampering with the right for Black people to vote, mm-hmm. and when you start tampering with gerrymandering locations and changing demographics, you might say the state has the choice in that matter, or the final word in that matter. But the truth is, the nation pays the price. The attempt to redirect the political destiny of Black cause is severe. And incidentally, the Black community is not exempt from criticism, because we're not smack dab in the middle of this fight. There are individuals who are, but I think the national mood is distracted. Black people are not where they were when we had the cause of the civil rights movement.
Carmen, how would you assess the state of the movement? It's been 3 years, really, since Black Lives Matter sort of crystallized. You had groups before that as well. Your perspective on where we sit right now.
The movement for Black Lives Matter is in a place where it was able to reflect back and now put together the demands on a federal level, right? The liberation of Black people, for trans, for Latino, for Black and brown, all these folks. And so, you know, hearing from Mr. B, just his analysis of it, is really interesting in the fact that I see it every day, and it's a lot easier to access versus, I believe, the past, because we see it in social media, right? It's so accessible. But we are also, I know for myself, trying to reconcile being a movement leader and being an executive director. And sometimes we have dual roles. We're trying to fundraise, meanwhile we're trying to be on the streets. We're trying to also have a presence, and then also be criticized by the way in which we do things, right? Because like we've had conversations before, there's a lane for all of us. But then there's also those, just like the past, in the past it was called COINTELPRO, but there's now those that, you know, police activists. Mm-hmm. But I certainly feel that the Black Lives Matter movement is headed in the right direction. They're looking at building something on a larger platform, not just statewide.
Do you believe, both of you, that when you talk about how do you make change, that the organizational infrastructure is there? Because you talked about this struggle between being an organizer slash activist versus being executive director. One of the criticisms I've heard from many quarters is that, is the movement properly organized? Is it functioning properly? There are individuals who are lone wolves, if you will. They're not tied to any particular group. They have a tremendous following. There are others, they have organizations, but they're not large. Because the reality is, what makes a movement successful is that as people come in and out, mm-hmm. as folks voluntarily leave or choose to stay, as some people pass away and other folks come in, the organization is still there to keep the work going. Is that a huge concern?
Well, I will just, I think that's what makes us unique, right? Before Justice League got the visibility that it did so quickly, we had been organizing in communities for so long, and that's what informed our 10 demands. We were able to mm-hmm. pull together rather quickly a set of 10 demands, policy priorities that we were working on a local, statewide, and federal level. As well as, I think what helps me navigate in multiple worlds is the fact that I have somebody that I could take counsel from, whether that's Mr. Belafonte or Nane, and that helps me be accountable. And I wouldn't be able to do this work without the guidance of Mr. B. Mm-hmm. We sit for hours and I will say, Mr. Belafonte, there's some things that I don't understand when it comes to divisiveness, and then he'll say something so profound like, those that are working towards the liberation of our people are only subject to friendship and support. Those that are being divisive are playing the enemy's game. He pulls us out of our ego. He provides a historical perspective of what's happened in the past and how it really hasn't changed, although our targets are different, but some of the players are still the same.
When Carmen and groups began to evidence the willingness to participate in making organizations more alert and more responsible for what was going on nationally, I was forced to take a look at the fact that the topography, the landscape, had seriously changed. We don't have a church leading a movement today.
And for the first time, the Black church is not leading this movement.
There are Black leaders in pockets of religion
right.
that speak out vigorously and beautifully, but it's not part of a larger, as a matter of fact, part of what we're doing on October 1st and October 2nd down in Atlanta will be to convene among a number of conventions mm-hmm. a ecumenical community, Cornell West and all the ministers we could think of, Father Flager out of Chicago, are all coming together to have a debate on where is the church in relationship to social change and social need. Where is that voice of Dr. King from the pulpits of America? What did he leave as a legacy to those who were in his profession? The clergy is absent.
Folks, look for my third part of my exclusive interview with Harry Belafonte tomorrow right here, News 1 on TV 1. And don't forget, the Many Rivers to Cross Festival of Music, Art, and Justice will take place October 1st and 2nd. For tickets, go to sankofa.org, sankofa.org. And Chris Rock, Common,
Others will be performing there, and we'll be on the scene as well. Time for a break. We'll be back. News 1 Now, TV 1.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
All right, folks, Evan Martin, Torrance Green, you know them as 02103. They got a new EP called Momentum. Recently, I talked with them. I've listened to a track from their new project called Nobody Bigger. And 2103 joins me via Skype from Detroit. Gentlemen, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. So the average person probably turns it on. They go, man, that's not a gospel group.
Oh, no. It's still gospel. It's the good news. We're just doing it in a way that it can reach everybody, you know? So this new album, Momentum, it's like a rap, hip-hop fused with gospel. But we wanted to do something new. We've been in the studio, you know, cultivating this craft. We didn't even really know we could rap till after this album. But it's turned out to be an awesome project, though. There's many things on there for everybody to enjoy, as usual. And Momentum, the message is just staying focused, you know, staying centered, you know, keep your momentum up, keep your drive. There's so many distractions around every day, you know, especially, you know, the phone, the TV, all that. So it's just about staying focused and keeping your momentum.
So how did you, though, I mean, you just said you didn't know you could rap. So how did you arrive at this concept?
Oh, man, this is, I'm Evan. Momentum was basically derived from the fact that we truly believe that we just want to die empty. You want to use every gift God has given you. So whether we're singing, whether we're rapping, whether we're dancing, whether we're doing some public speaking or mentoring, whatever it is, it is the goal, or should be the goal of everyone, to use every tool, you know, in every facet, whether that's in education, it can be in politics, it doesn't matter. And so we decided, hey, let's try this rapping thing. We can do it. And we got this whole album, and I'm just, we're really, really excited about it. We're 2103 as a whole. We're faster, we're stronger, we're better. Like you said, we've been in the game 13 years, award winning. And so at this point, it's about creating legacy and doing things that you haven't done before to keep your audience and keep our listeners engaged. And so that's what this album, Momentum, represents.
You spoke of, in terms of doing something different for a different audience. How critical is it for gospel to be able to present different faces as opposed to a traditional view, if you will?
Oh, man, it's incredibly relevant. You know, the gospel is the good news, and so the gospel should be relevant to every generation. The message is the same, but the method is different. And so many people in our demo, in our age group, aren't listening to the same traditional sounds that they may have grown up listening to in church. And so you want to make sure that you have something for Sunday mornings, but you also have something for Wednesday and for the Friday night turn up when people are riding around and hanging out. So you just want to make sure that the message of hope, that Jesus is the hope of the world, we still believe that, and so that can be in every aspect and facet of your life.
What about the reaction? And because, again, when people see you, they go, it's really? Really?
Exactly.
Oh, we've seen
really,
it all.
Really, y'all a gospel group. Really?
Exactly. I mean, the mothers on the front row grimming us up and down. Y'all ain't gospel. Y'all don't know nothing about life. Y'all ain't been through nothing. Well, you know, we get it all, but, you know, the youth is, it's just awesome to be young and be vibrant and still be able to spread the gospel, the good news. It's just, it's an awesome thing.
So, favorite track for you, each one, on the new CD?
My favorite track would be He Knows. The song says, He knows. God knows all of my struggles. God knows all of my issues. But He also knows my dreams and my aspirations. And so there's nothing that I can think or nothing that I can go through that Jesus is not a witness to and that He can't help me through. So that would be my favorite one. It's like a trap, bouncy type groove to it.
Mine would be Nobody Bigger. It's a track that I wrote. It's just putting God first, keeping Him the head, putting nothing before Him. And that's the main focus of the song. It's also a trap gospel type of song, but you'll definitely love it. There's also a remix to it on the album. It features people such as CJ Wise, Kent Jones, J Moss. So, yeah.
All right. The CD is called Momentum. Duo 2103. Gents, we appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Last night, 49ers played the Rams. Monday Night Football, Colin Kaepernick still took a knee yesterday, of course, protesting the national anthem. Here's the photo there. And so he was joined by a fellow player. And so he makes it clear he is not going to back down from his protest. Folks, don't forget tomorrow, part 3 of my exclusive interview with Harry Belafonte right here on News One Now. I want to thank Chris for being here as well, Lauren, and Super Black, Cleo. Appreciate it. They clear up. Don't forget, y'all better get that money to the museum.
I already did.
Y'all gave?
I gave mine.
All right. Holla.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.